Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. Oscar movie season has started, so it's movie week this week on Culturetopia. In 1956, two icons, Marilyn Monroe and Sir Laurence Olivier, got together in London to make a movie. The Prince and the Showgirl was a royal flop. We've got a piece about the new movie, My Week with Marilyn, about the horrible experience everyone had on set. And NPR Susan Stamper goes on the set of the new Muppets movie with belt wrangler Bill Beretta and director James Bobin to learn what's new in Muppetry and what techniques never change. And the new silent film, The Artist, presented challenges for the actors, even those of the four-legged variety. But first...
Last weekend, vampires and penguins took over the Cineplex. Thanksgiving has brought a Muppet invasion, so what next? Well, there are 37 days left in 2011, and almost that many movies waiting to open. So we asked Bob Mondello for a selective preview.
How do you like your Steven Spielberg? Classy and epic like Saving Private Ryan, or raucous and comic like Indiana Jones? Actually, this year, you're okay either way because in the space of a single week, Spielberg will open two potential blockbusters. The Indiana Jones-ish one is a treasure hunt based on a comic book, The Adventures of Tintin.
I don't think you realize this, but you're about to walk into a whole mess of danger.
It's Spielberg's first foray into 3D motion capture technology.
Look at this.
The results are pretty gorgeous. Non-stop action on several continents, not to mention in the air and at sea. And a mere 4 days after Tintin opens, the director will be back with a drama that's a bit more hooves on the ground, as it were. A battlefield saga set in World War I about a British youngster and a noble steed.
What is it?
It's a horse they find wandering about in no man's land.
What kind of an horse?
A miraculous kind of an horse, be my guess.
War Horse is also a hit play on Broadway at the moment, and Spielberg's not the only one who's looking stageward for the holidays. There'll be star-studded Shakespeare, Coriolanus, which will mark the directing debut of Ralph Fiennes, and the Broadway smash Gods of Carnage will hit the screen as Just Carnage, a comedy in which two couples meet to discuss a fight between their 11-year-old sons.
Do you know what they were arguing about? Because Ethan won't say a word.
Ethan wouldn't let Zachary be a part of his gang.
Ethan has a gang.
And he called him a snitch.
Did you know that Ethan had a gang?
No, but I'm thrilled to hear it.
Why are you thrilled?
Because I had one. I was the leader.
So was I.
By the end, director Roman Polanski will have these folks behaving even more childishly than their kids. Any more childish, in fact, and you'd need to call a sitter, though probably not the one from The Sitter, who's lazy and irresponsible, as played by Jonah Hill. Other misbehaving grown-ups include a mean-spirited writer of teen fiction in Young Adult, who returns to her hometown to reclaim her high school boyfriend.
You can come to the city with me like we always planned.
Mavis, I'm a married man.
We can beat this thing together.
As written by Diablo Cody and played by Charlize Theron, this is a woman on a mission. Men try to stop her at their peril, and that's something you might also say of men who come up against Maggie Thatcher, at least as she's pictured in the film Iron Lady. We meet the British Prime Minister when she's in her dotage, remembering when she was first being groomed to run for elective office.
That hat has got to go, and the pearls, but the... main thing is your voice. It's too high and it has no authority.
I may be persuaded to surrender the hat. The pearls, however, are absolutely non-negotiable.
Meryl Streep transforming herself again.
That's the tone that we want to strike.
You can't hand Streep an Oscar nomination just yet, though, because Glenn Close has an even bigger transformation up her sleeve. In Albert Nobbs, she plays a woman who managed for 30 years in 19th century Ireland to pass as a man.
Jesus, you're a woman.
You won't tell on me.
What's your name?
Albert.
Your real name?
Albert.
As long as we're introducing possible Best Actress nominees, let's include the English language girl with a dragon tattoo, Rooney Mara.
Hey, hey, who do you think you are?
Can I call you Elizabeth? I want you to help me catch a killer of women.
That other voice is Daniel Craig, and they're directed by David Fincher, who proved with Zodiac and Seven that he knows his way around a suspense film. There are quite a lot of those in the holiday mix, including a fresh version of an espionage classic by John le Carré.
All I want from you is one code name.
Tinker. Tailor. Soldier. Spy.
Gary Oldman plays George Smiley, stepping into shoes once occupied by Alec Guinness. For those who prefer a pop take on covert operations, Tom Cruise and his Impossible Missions Force are back in Ghost Protocol, trying presumably not to become ghosts.
The Russians are classifying this as an undeclared act of war. The blame points to you and your team. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed.
So what happens now?
Your mission, should you choose to accept it.
Oops. Well, that's awkward. Guess they're on their own. Okay, let's shift gears for a sec. This being Hollywood's prestige season, when everyone's jockeying for awards consideration, the art house crowd will have plenty to choose from, including A Separation, about a family in Iran faced with a life-altering decision, Shame, in which Michael Fassbender plays a sex addict whose life is in crisis, In the Land of Blood and Honey, an ethnic cleansing drama that finds Angelina Jolie not in front of the camera but behind it as both writer and director, and Pariah, the story of an African-American teen who's growing up lesbian in Brooklyn.
I'm really sorry I bugged out. It's just I didn't know that you... I wasn't expecting that.
First kiss? It's cool.
Her parents don't think it's so cool, which explains the title, Pariah. Other stories dealing with family crises include Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, based on a novel about the aftermath of 9/11. We Need to Talk About Kevin, in which Tilda Swinton tries to understand why her teenage son went on a killing spree. We Bought a Zoo, based on a memoir about a family that, well, buys a zoo. And though I hesitate to mention this one, the saga of a long-planned family cruise ship vacation that goes terribly awry.
Alvin!
Chipwrecked with singing chipmunks. Not the way you want to spend the holidays? Well, there are other horrors at the Cineplex. Alien invaders, abandoned children, a film directed by Madonna. Happily, there are also heroes you can count on, among them Sherlock Holmes and Watson in A Game of Shadows.
What are we up against here?
The most formidable criminal mind in Europe.
Professor James Moriarty.
If we can stop him, we shall prevent the collapse of Western civilization. No pressure.
No pressure at all. Except maybe at the box office. I'm Bob Mondello.
In 1956, two major stars, Marilyn Monroe and Sir Laurence Olivier, got together in London to make a movie. It was a comedy called The Prince and the Showgirl, about the lonely Prince Regent of Carpathia who meets a flirty American showgirl.
Marina, Elsie Marina, that's my name.
Of course, I'll stupid though.
It's just my stage name, Elsie Marina. My dad was a Marine, see? My real name is Elsie Stoltzenberg.
Indeed.
I decided to change it when I decided to stay in England. You see, the company I came over with from the States, they got stranded in New York.
In the Strand, really. Let's all go down the Strand, have a banana.
Never heard of that movie? Well, there's a very good reason for it. It was a huge flop. This week, a new movie about the making of that movie opens nationwide. Michelle Williams plays Marilyn Monroe and Kenneth Branagh plays Olivier. My Week with Marilyn tells the story of 1 week during the film shoot, the behind-the-scenes clashes, the misaligned acting styles, and the pursuit of personal ambitions. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has more.
Marilyn Monroe, Laurence Olivier, huge stars, worlds apart. In 1956, Monroe's career as a sexy starlet was taking off. She'd recently made 7-Year Itch, the movie that created one of the most iconic images of all time. Monroe in a white dress, standing on a subway grate.
Ooh, do you feel the breeze from the subway? Isn't it delicious?
Laurence Olivier, on the other hand, was a king of the English stage and screen.
Now is the winter of our discontent.
made glorious summer by this son of York.
Olivier, the serious thespian, Monroe, the charming sexpot. But she was hoping to change that image. In 1956, she married playwright Arthur Miller. She started her own company, Marilyn Monroe Productions. She was headed to London to work with Olivier.
All of these things sort of fed her aspiration, her dream of becoming a serious actress, an actress taken seriously.
Simon Curtis, director of My Week with Marilyn, says Laurence Olivier had his own issues. His marriage to Vivian Leigh was in a rut. And at 49, he was worried about becoming a has-been, says Kenneth Branagh, who plays Olivier in the new movie.
He, I think, felt that although revered, respected, and an institution in Britain, that he was perhaps regarded by some almost as a kind of dinosaur, as a sort of fossil.
Branagh says Olivier was hoping to renew himself by playing opposite the fresh young Marilyn Monroe. Monroe was hoping the regal Olivier, who also directed Prince and the Showgirl, would rub off on her. Instead, he intimidated her, and she exasperated him.
Cut!
What is the matter now?
Among other things, Branagh says, they did not share the same work ethic.
Marilyn would show up late, sometimes as late as 3 days late, and that created often comic frustration for Olivier. I don't know how funny he found it at the time, but in the movie, it allows us to perhaps sympathise or empathise for a bit with his plight. He doesn't always deal with it well.
You wait! Marilyn, please, 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 tell me how I can help you.
During the filming of Prince and the Showgirl, Laurence Olivier also had to deal with Monroe's acting coach, Paula Strasberg.
The reason Marilyn can't remember the line is because she doesn't believe the situation her character is in.
Then she should pretend to believe it.
Pretend? We're talking about the difference between the truth and artificial crap.
We're in absolute agreement. Acting is all about truth, and if you can fake that, you'll have a jolly good career.
Here's the thing. The Prince and the Showgirl was meant to be a light comedy. Olivier plays a prince, Monroe plays a showgirl. Nothing too deep as far as Olivier was concerned. But Monroe and many other American actors at the time were hooked on Strasberg's method acting.
They were sort of talking two different languages at this point.
Director Simon Curtis.
In 1956, much was made of the difference between English acting, theatre-based external acting, which Olivier was a great advocate of, you know, false noses, accents, limps and so on. And American style of acting, Marilyn was a recent devotee of the Strasberg school, you know, the method, which meant that she loved to investigate inside the character, the interior life, the psychology of her character.
I don't know who else she is. I can't act her if I don't know who she is.
You have her, precisely. You understand her inside out. I'm in awe of your gift. We all are.
She's not real.
Then why not simply rely on your natural talents?
Are you saying you don't want me to act?
Marilyn, will you just try to be sexy? Isn't that what you do?
That humiliation Marilyn Monroe faced from Olivier on the set of Prince and the Showgirl is legendary. And it happened at a time when Monroe was hoping to eventually distance herself from the dumb blonde persona. Easier said than done for a woman in Hollywood in the 1950s. In a press conference for My Week with Marilyn, Michelle Williams, who plays her in the new movie, sympathized with Monroe.
I wish that she could experience what I've been able to, which is to work outside of a studio system, to not be bound to playing the same role, to not be a contract player, to not basically be on salary and to have to take what's given to you.
In My Week with Marilyn, you get the sense both Monroe and Olivier felt there was a lot riding on this movie, that somehow it would be the game changer their images needed. In the end, the prince and the showgirl made them look like just that. As one critic put it, Olivier looks like a stuffed shirt, and Monroe mainly has to giggle, wiggle, and flirt.
No more, please.
Oh, one more will not hurt a fly.
Maybe, but you know what they say, drunk as a fly.
That is really quite excellent. I can see you have a witty little tongue, Miss Marina.
I have.
Fortunately for them, both of their next movies got nominated for Oscars. Marilyn Monroe went on to do Some Like It Hot, and Laurence Olivier was nominated for Best Actor in The Entertainer. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
My Week with Marilyn has generated its own Oscar buzz. You can see clips at our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Two movies opening this week tap into nostalgia for old films. One is the latest from Martin Scorsese. The other is a black and white silent film from an obscure French director. In spite of the silence, The Artist is generating a lot of talk, including talk about Oscars. NPR's Netta Ulaby met the director at a landmark in downtown Los Angeles where part of the movie was filmed.
This 1920s movie palace is a faded fantasia of Art Deco design. Underneath the swooping marquee stands the director with a difficult name, Michel Hazanavicius. He's lanky in blue jeans and bright yellow sneakers.
So now we're facing the Orpheum. It's a theater on Broadway, I think. Yeah, that's it. On Broadway, downtown.
Today it's a downtown stretch of grimy storefronts selling knockoff purses and cheap jewelry. But with a flourish, Hazanavicius transports you back in time to a dazzling Hollywood premiere, 1927, the era of Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks.
It's mythic.
The movie, The Artist, follows the decline of a dashing silent film star. Imagine Fairbanks with a whiff of Rudolph Valentino. He's playfully virile with a pencil mustache. But the newfangled talkies leave him behind, even as his lovely tap-dancing protege blossoms into a new screen darling. Director Michel Hazanavicius thinks every director secretly yearns to make a silent film. It's cinematic storytelling at its purest. And The Artist is immersive in the same way great radio can be. There's a sense missing. Your brain fills it in.
So you do it with your own imagination, with your own ghosts, your own life, your own sounds, your own reference. So it makes the movie much more yours, in a way.
I saw The Artist with someone who swore later he could remember what the actors sounded like. The film's critically adored, it's a smash in France, and the lead won the Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival. Still,
how difficult was it to get people to finance a silent black and white movie?
Yeah, that was one of the most difficult parts of the entire process.
What helped Hazanavicius was the fact that back at home he'd made two hit comedies about a French secret agent.
Ça va, Jack?
Ça va bien.
Alors, allons-nous sur cet avion.
If you're ever bored one night at home, it's worth checking out the OSS 117 movies. They happen to star the same two leads as The Artist. So producers signed on, reluctantly, to Hazanavicius' wild dream of filming a black-and-white silent movie on location in Los Angeles.
They didn't say no exactly, but it was a very shy yes.
The Artist was shot on classic old Hollywood backlots as well as historic locations here. The cast includes some great American faces, character actors like John Goodman and James Cromwell, who you maybe remember from 6 Feet Under and Babe.
My goal was not to be in a silent picture.
Cromwell says most actors prefer to be heard. They're accustomed to using their voices and acting in ways that work in contemporary film.
The trick is to always come under in the performance and do very, very little with your face. Your face, you keep your eyes open always because you don't want to blink, because when you blink, the director's going to cut away from you. So you betray as little of your inner life through your face as possible, and everything is done by the dialogue.
Acting in a silent picture meant rediscovering how your face and body could express your character. Of course, music also does a lot of the emotional heavy lifting in a silent film. Director Michel Hazanavicius played it as the actors worked to set the mood. Now, as he ambles down a particularly noisy Los Angeles street, he says it was a real benefit not to have to worry, say, about sirens.
What's great with a silent movie is that kind of sound doesn't... it's okay, you can shoot.
The mechanics of silent film production was also a blessing for one of the film's other stars, a scruffy dog whose trainer could bark orders while the cameras were rolling.
Usually he has to wait for the actors stop talking. He could really talk to his dog during the shooting, and maybe that's why the dog is so good in the movie.
So good, the dog actually won a special award.
La Palme Dog, which is a pun on La Palme d'Or and La Palme Dog. I think it's a bone or something.
If Oscar watchers are right, Hasan Avicius may take home the movie world's biggest bone of all, the Oscar for Best Picture. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Okay, the Muppets are back. Their first feature film in over a decade opens this week.
It's time to play the music. It's time to light the lights.
The movie stars Jason Segel, Amy Adams, and a cast of thousands, some of whom are Muppets, acting like movie stars.
There's only one Miss Piggy.
Only a few journalists were permitted on the set during filming, and one of them was NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg, who met some of the puppeteers who make the Muppets move.
We visited the Muppets, that's the name of the movie, last winter on a huge soundstage at Universal Studios in Burbank, California, picking our way through cables and cameras and stuff that would make Oscar's trash can look tidy. We found the Muppet diva getting ready for her close-up.
I am so easy. I don't have any demands at all. Merely chocolate in my dressing room, flowers in my trailer. Of course, the trailer has to be a semi.
Since their last big screen encounter, Muppets in Space, in 1999, the Muppets each went their separate ways. But when they learned that their old Muppet Theater in Los Angeles is being torn down so an oil tycoon can drill underneath, they reunite to save it. How? They hold a telethon.
We have Muppets standing by to take your calls.
Yes, we are. Good evening, everyone.
Could I have a large pizza with ham and...
Yes, and boy, do we have a wonderful show.
The movie's Muppet Theater was assembled on a set built for the 1925 silent film Phantom of the Opera. That old stage set, draped with dusty red velvet swags, still looks phantom-ridden.
I'll be looking for Kevin.
Oh, and Sweetum, so we need Matt.
In a cramped balcony box, some Muppets crowd together to shoot a scene. First, puppeteer Matt Vogel has a problem.
I have a place where I can stick my hand through here if I wanted to, and I don't want you to see it on camera.
Muppet Captain Bill Beretta races to the rescue.
I have to think about this all day now.
You would think it was Olivier doing Hamlet, but no. Bill Beretta makes decisions like this every other second. It's not that easy being Muppet Captain. Beretta also performs some Muppets. He took on a few characters enacted by the late Muppet creator Jim Henson. Characters like the Swedish chef, Ralph the dog, Dr. Teeth. And Bill Beretta performs some newer Muppets like Pepe, a little Spanish-speaking shrimp.
He's not a shrimp, please. He's a king prawn, okay? It's a big difference. The size is what matters, okay?
Okay. Pepe's performer Bill Beretta says his wife's Spanish aunt was the inspiration.
She had this great way of talking to people. She only spoke in statements. You know, she would say, "This is a black shirt, okay?" Yeah, okay. "Come on, Bill, we go to the mall, okay?" That's what she said all the time. It was okay at the end of everything. So
during a brainstorming session for a 1996 Muppet TV show, Beretta found himself describing his aunt-in-law.
And she was a little bit selfish in a way, and I said, you know, she's very fine, but a little shellfish. And I said, shellfish, by mistake. And one of the writer-directors said, wait a minute, okay, maybe it's a lobster, or it's a crab, or a shrimp. And, oh, maybe a shrimp. No, wait, it's a king prawn, because maybe he has a problem with size.
I love this. It takes a village to make a prawn.
Absolutely.
Totally collaborative.
And I think that was something that Jim created.
Yeah.
That was always the way it was. Just glad to be a part of that process.
Yeah, but how did the aunt-in-law feel? She was not offended?
No, she loved it. She said, it is okay, okay.
Everybody's making their way in.
Some special guest stars show up to do cameo roles in the telethon scene, helping raise money to save the Muppet Theater. So, also jammed into that small balcony box, Whoopi Goldberg, James Carville, Judd Hirsch, Neil Patrick Harris, the director yells,
"Rolling!"
And the actors start ad-libbing with one another and the Muppets. But hand puppets can't see the stars or anybody or thing for that matter. Movie magic, however, helps the puppeteers be invisible. Muppet Captain Bill Beretta explains.
We have monitors in specific places so that the puppeteers are able to see what they're doing and at the same time see what the other person is doing. and at the same time, moment-to-moment reacting, as an actor would do. So it's all those things that come together at once.
Principal Wise, any of the front row?
The puppeteers have to pretzel themselves out of camera range. They sit, they squat, they belly down under tables, ledges. Sometimes the sets are raised 4 feet off the ground for easier Muppet maneuvering. That's the inside work with lots of lifting. Outside work is even trickier. For a big song and dance number, Hollywood Boulevard was shut down for 2 days. Dancers, human actors, and Muppets all performed in the real world.
We have to be down on the ground with little rolly chairs and straining and trying to get your head down below the shot, and it's much more difficult to be out in the real world.
Here we go.
James Bobin is the movie's director.
Cut. Right, good. Got that?
It's his first film, and he's a total newbie to the Muppets.
No Muppet training whatsoever, as you can probably tell.
So Bobin relies heavily on Muppet veterans like Bill Beretta.
So whenever I have an idea, I say, Bill, is that possible? And he tells me yes or no. Normally he says yes, which is good for me. But there are obviously limitations in shooting puppets. Door handles are a nightmare, always the wrong height. Windowsills, a no-no, very difficult to get around windowsills. Generally, they're hand puppets, so they come from underneath. They often have no legs. Shh, whisper it quietly, don't tell people that.
Now, you would think in this age of computer-generated special effects, they could make some Muppet legs. But James Bobin says no.
This is very much a puppet festival, and it's all about, you know, felt and fur and seeing that for real, not computer graphics.
And won't all the Muppets lovers out there be glad about that?
We are the Muppets.
Hello.
Hello.
The Muppets, the movie, opens the day before Thanksgiving. I'm Susan Stanberg, NPR News. Kermit, has it gotten any easier being green?
You know, it has. I think it has gotten easier. I think people are more accepting of green. I know I myself went to a Being Green support group. And it's helped quite a lot. But can I say something directly to your listeners? If any of you wake up in the morning and you find yourself green, I would suggest you see a doctor.
Green's the color of spring.
Throughout Latin America, stories of drug lords permeate popular culture. A television series called The Cartel of the Snitches is a hit in Colombia. And in Mexico, soap operas glamorize drug lords while ballads recount the exploits of drug runners. Well, a new movie called Miss Bala is now out in Mexico, and it's being hailed as something quite different in the genre of narco-inspired art. It captures the terror caused by Mexico's ongoing drug war, and some critics have complained that it's too close to reality. NPR's Jason Beaubien has our story from Mexico City.
In the movie Miss Bala, the main character Laura sets out to enter the Miss Baja California competition in Tijuana. By no fault of her own, she ends up getting sucked deep into the world of a drug gang.
Viva Miss Baja California!
The bubbly, vacuous world of the beauty pageant clashes sharply against the brutal cartel violence playing out in the streets. Gerardo Naranjo, who directed the film, says the inspiration for the story came from the arrest of the former Miss Sinaloa. In 2008, Miss Sinaloa was paraded in handcuffs in front of the media, along with a group of alleged cartel members. Naranjo says he wanted to make a movie that captures the feeling of despair that spread across much of Mexico.
So, you know, when we began the film, we said, what if we make a movie that is actually not about anything that we've been seeing on the news, not about dead bodies, not about blood, not about the drugs, but about this state of fear that people have, and that was the goal.
The title of the movie, playing off the beauty pageant theme, means Miss Bullet. Early in Miss Bala, Laura inadvertently witnesses an attack by the gang Las Estrellas on a group of U.S. drug enforcement agents. The DEA agents are partying in Tijuana. There are no good guys in this movie. The U.S. officials are sleazy, the local police are corrupt, the gang members are brutal. Soon after abducting Laura, the leader of Las Estrellas, Lino, is sitting beside her in the back seat of a car in a vacant parking garage. He whispers that he's going to help her.
Está bien, Canelita. Yo te voy a ayudar. Pero también necesito que jales algo por mí. ¿Tú qué dices?
From that moment on, Lino uses the beauty pageant contestant in every sense of the word, as a smuggler, a decoy, a courier, a whore. Daniel Hernandez, writing in a blog for the LA Times, called watching Miss Bala an exercise in helplessness and ultimately hopelessness. Given the film's bleak message, Miss Bala is doing surprisingly well at the box office. Carlos Gomez Iniesta, the editor-in-chief of Cine Premier magazine in Mexico City, says this film makes a statement about the collapse of public security that's accompanied President Felipe Calderón's drug war.
I think that the film portrays that if you are a victim of these guys, it's almost impossible that anybody can help you. That's the final message for me. So it's really hard to see my country like that.
Gomez says Miss Bala is an important film in Mexico right now. It's by a relatively young director. It's centered around the dominant political issue of the day. And Gomez says it doesn't try to glamorize the drug trade. The cartel members often seem bored by the mundane work of killing people and dumping bodies. Gomez says director Naranjo shows the gang members as ordinary workers trudging along at their trade.
They are not the lords. They are not the king of the land. They are like normal people, like really workers.
Other films have taken very different approaches to the subject. Many paint the drug lords as smart, handsome heroes surrounded by luxury cars and busty women. Last year, the film El Infierno used piles of dead bodies for comic relief. Director Naranjo says he wanted to make a movie about Mexico at a time when criminals have gained unprecedented power.
No, I have no intention of giving a hope in the film. I think it has to be a portrayal of the times we are living, and I think I will be lying if I propose a way out, because I don't think we know the way out.
Miss Bala tracks one ordinary citizen's torment in the midst of the drug war. The viewer, at least in Mexico, isn't allowed to forget that Laura's descent into hell could be real. Jason Beaubien, NPR News, Mexico City.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.